Welcome, everyone. It is always always a real pleasure and privilege to have these events. So my name is Nawushi. I'm a facilitator, but I organize these with a lovely group of volunteers. They happen every Friday now. So we normally have a monk called Bhante Sujata doing the talks. He's away on a retreat at the moment, and very, very lucky to have one of the nuns from Santi, Venerable Pasana, with us today. I'll just do some brief housekeeping. Is anyone here new to these events? Welcome. If you have any questions at all throughout the day, evening, just come and find me. I also have a mailing list, so if you want reminders of these events, I can put your name down. Toilets are just past the elevators, and anything else. So I might just start by doing a welcome to country. Just wanted to acknowledge the Indigenous custodians of the lands that we're gathering on, the Cammeraygal people, just to pay my respects to their elders. I'll just also just briefly mention there's a project called Sutta Print, which our friends Ming and Tom Harbert are doing, to print Bhante's sort of translations of the early Buddhist teachings. If you're interested, there's some flyers at the back. Welcome to grab it. You can get a copy for yourself, or you can donate it to educational institutions, any temples that you want to nominate. Of course, they're on their list, so they really appreciate support. It's really amazing that he's done translations into contemporary English. So if you're interested to support it, I recommend it. You can also read them on suttacentral.net. Just quickly, if you're new, there's a newbie's guide that just gives you a bit of an overview of some frequently asked questions. Feel free to grab that from the back. And also just wanted to encourage everyone to take a flyer and spread the word. So please consider all that. So Venerable is from Santi Forest Monastery. So Venerable Pasana uses they-them pronouns. They're a fully ordained Buddhist monastic and alms mendicant in the Australian forest tradition. They took novice ordination in 2019 and full ordination in 2021 at Dhammasara Monastery with Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Hasapanya as preceptors. Their passion for the early Buddhist texts is at the core of their practice. They help to coordinate and facilitate events for Rainbow LGBTQI Buddhist community, and are a member of management team on the Sutta Central Discussion Forum. They were born in Amsterdam, grew up predominantly in Adelaide, Australia, currently reside at Kamaloka Vihara, as I mentioned, a residence of Santi Forest Monastery in New South Wales. By the way, I also highly recommend visiting Santi. It's a very beautiful monastery in the Southern Highlands. Venerable Pasana acknowledges the people of the Dharawal and Gundagora Nations as the traditional guardians of the land on which they live. Thank you, Venerable. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Neil, for inviting me, and for everyone for coming here on a cold night when you could be online in your PJs. I mean, if you're online in your PJs and you're overseas in America or something, then good on you for being in your PJs and tuning in at, what, 3 a.m. or whatever it is. But okay, so I think what we normally do is we start off with a little bit of chanting, and there are chanting sheets around if anyone needs them. And then after that, we'll do some meditation. Then we'll have a short tea break, and then there'll be a Dharma talk on the first Tuesday of the month. And the following Friday, Bhante Sujata normally does a thing called Dark Week, where he talks about kind of darker topics. This will be a light dark week, but if anyone's not up for L-I-T-E, dark week, because I'm just not as dark as Bhante, takes more practice, I guess. So if you're not up for that, then you can always check out at the break. We'll be talking about monsters, ableism, eugenics, all that kind of thing. So we'll see how it goes, but we've also got plenty of suttas in there, and hopefully some sort of resolution at the end and a bit of time for us all to chat. So yeah. Okay, so let's begin with some chanting.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Duttiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Duttiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Duttiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Iti piso bhagava arahaṃ sammasambuddho. Vijja charana sampanno sugato lokavidu. Anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati. Satta deva manusanang buddho bhagavati. Svakato bhagavata dhammo. Sanditiko akaliko. Ehipasiko opanayiko pachatang veditabo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Samicchipatipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Yadidam chattari purisa yugani. Atha purisa puggala. Issa bhagavato savakasangho. Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakineyo anjali karaniyo. Anuttarang punyaketang lokasati.
Okay, so I guess this is where we talk about meditation. So I guess what I want to talk about today is finding that comfort and pleasure in meditation, because I think as Buddhists sometimes we can fall into the habit of just kind of doing our meditation because we're doing our 20 minutes 5 times a week, like Bhante says, ticking it off the list, getting it done. And, you know, sometimes, you know, maybe you've been meditating for, you know, 5 years, 5 months, 5 weeks, whatever, and it can become a bit rote, it can become a little bit dry. And so, you know, remembering that the reason that we've chosen to do meditation, right? Like, of all the things that you could be doing tonight, you all chose to come here. A big Aussie mudita, otherwise known as Good on Ya. and for making that choice, right? And so when we make the choice to sit down and meditate, or even just have the wholesome intention to sit down and meditate, we're choosing that over all sorts of other things, right? We're saying, look, maybe a little bit of peace in my mind would be good, would be beneficial for myself, for my loved ones, and for the rest of the world. And maybe a little bit of kindness and gentleness, a little bit more mindfulness. We're saying these things are actually important to us, right? This is why we make these kinds of choices, hopefully, right? Hopefully we're not just trying to get a good Buddhist sticker for the day, but, I mean, like, it's better than doing other things. It's better than robbing banks. It's better than playing computer games. It's better than all sorts of things you could be doing, even if you are just ticking it off. But you may as well have some fun and have some pleasure while you're doing it. So how we do this is probably going to be a little bit individual, but what I encourage you to do when you sit down to meditate is have that intention to enjoy the meditation, to find that pleasure in that meditation. It's there, and you can. It's like very subtle. It's like not like chili paste. It's more like, I don't know, vanilla. No, vanilla is not even subtle. Anyway, it's a very subtle flavor. Is peace, right? And so we have to become connoisseurs of peace, connoisseurs of that gentle touch of the breath as it strokes us, right? And it might be that we just have to tighten and loosen our attention a little bit just to find that spot where we get the pleasure in focus, right? And it might be in all sorts of places in our bodies, right? And it's just to find that place and to experience that pleasure, because meditation can actually be pleasurable if you tune into that aspect. And so much of our Dharma practice, so much of our meditation practice is tuning our perception into different aspects of perception, different aspects of our experience. So I kind of encourage you to investigate that in our meditation. We're going to sit for about 20 minutes now. I'm just going to get my watch out. Because I have a very minimalist phone which blacks out the time. Oh, thank you. I can't see the clock from here, though, because... So this is okay. I have my little watch and now I'm good. So I won't leave you guys meditating for too long. Can't have too much happiness, too much peace. Gosh, what would we do? Okay, so if you can just get yourself into a comfortable, upright position, or a position where you can be alert. And bringing to mind that wholesome intention to practice meditation. This is a source of great happiness and great peace. And so to do this, we need to set the intention to put down all the things from our day and our week. Maybe we can just feel them still pulling in our bodies, whether it's the drive or commute to get here, or the tiredness of a busy week, conversations we've had, any of those things. They just naturally echo in our minds and our bodies. So you might just want to take a deep breath and let it out when you're ready, letting go of the past. And the future hasn't yet arrived. So we can just put down the reins of the future. It's okay, you can place them next to you, you can pick them up afterwards. And really now is when our future is made. And then we can check in with our mind, our body, with our heart. And just see, how are you doing in there, little me? And whatever comes up, you can just greet it with a bit of gentleness, with a bit of kindness. And taking a few minutes to ground yourself in your body. Noticing what your feet feel like. Your lower legs. Your upper legs. Maybe you just feel the touch of the cloth on your skin and the weight of your body on the chair. If you need to have a wriggle and adjust your posture to be more comfortable. It's a good time now that your mindfulness is a bit brighter. Just feeling the body sitting. Feeling any sensations in the hips, lower back, abdomen. Upper torso. And shoulders. Arms. And maybe there's a subtle, pleasant, tingling sensation in your hands as they're very sensitive.
It's not there, that's okay. You don't have to force it. Noticing sensations in your throat, back of your neck. Base of your skull. Eye sockets. Muscles around your eyes and your eyebrows. Your cheeks. Again, another sensitive area where you might feel a little bit of tingling. Your lips and your jaw. And zooming out to see the whole body, maybe there's a subtle vibration in the body, maybe it's just in one place, maybe for you it's just not there right now. And we can turn our attention towards the natural flow of the breath. You can ask yourself, how do I know I'm breathing right now? And wherever you notice the breath from that question, you can just gently greet it with a little Buddha smile. Like an old friend who's been taking care of you your whole life. Mindfully breathing in, feeling that sense of safety and care that the breath provides. Naturally letting the breath flow out again, letting go. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Maybe there's a subtle vibration that comes along with the breath. See if you can notice that just by zooming in or zooming out. With an attitude of this is good enough, whatever I'm experiencing. Breathing in, welcoming the breath. Breathing out, accepting the breath. Allowing the gentle rhythm, the breathing to settle down inside the body. Whatever you're experiencing right now, this is good enough, however you're experiencing the breath. Just inviting the breath to caress and flow through. And as we come towards the end of the meditation, taking a look back into how we used our minds, did you experience any pleasure in the meditation or any peace? And if so, what was the attitude that made room for that to happen? And if you didn't, what happened instead? What was your attitude? Now, just letting your perception come back to one that's a bit more normal, just noticing the touch of cloth on your skin, the weight of the body in the room, putting down the pleasure, putting down the breath, and coming back to a mind that's clear, open, and equanimous. And finally, we can dedicate the merits of this practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize nirvana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. Okay, so we'll have a short break. We'll have a break and we'll get technical.
Here we go. Very, very good. I can report back that you're all much better behaved when I'm here than, than when Bunda's here. Okay. So, yeah, like I said, this is the traditional dark week, and it seems for some reason I have landed both dark weeks while Bunte's away. So we'll see. I was thinking about what to talk about and whether I actually wanted to do dark week, because I think, like, for some of us, depending on our life circumstances, the conditions that we've grown up with, all sorts of things, then we have a different tolerance to darkness. And, like, that just
is how we are. That's our conditioned nature, right? And we can think of all the different things that might come into play with that in terms of our gender or our race or ethnicity, to be more precise, or our economic status growing up, or all these things, right? These are all kind of intersecting forces that play out on our lives and just have different factors on how we exist in the world and how complicated our lives are. So I just wanted to acknowledge that to start out. I sometimes check out on Dark Week myself. So we'll do, yeah, it's going to be mostly sutras, but I thought that I was inspired by reading something, a few different things actually. First was a Canadian, Chinese-Canadian writer named Kai Cheng Tom, who is a trans woman, an activist, a poet, and an amazing thinker, much smarter than me, I think. I don't know. Anyway, I'm very much in awe of her, and she talks about monsters in all sorts of different ways, and I find that interesting. So I just happened to read something of hers about monsters and monstrosity and was inspired, and I looked up a small quote from Kai Cheng, and I thought I'd share it and then see where we go from there. So she writes, we are all monsters in our darkest hearts, and the monsters within us are powerful beings, protectors, harbingers, bringers of horror and strength and change. They are also harm bringers, hurtful beings, creatures that lash out, and so they're like strong forces, right? And they're also often the things that lurk in the shadows. And I think this is the thing that I wanted to tie in with a Buddhist perspective, right? Because what we're trying to do is shine a brighter light on our experience, right? We're trying to see more. The darkness is the ignorance or the avidya, right? And so we're trying to understand the things that are in the shadows. And so there are different aspects to this. There's the things that, but they overlap, I guess. Now a Venn diagram pops into my mind, but anyway, very nerdy. But they're things that overlap, because there's the stuff that comes from, say, our personal upbringing and our conditioning, all those things kind of that I spoke about at the beginning. But then there's the broader stories and societal context that we're in as well, right? And a lot of those things are very subtle, right? I think sometimes it can be easier to see the things that we pushed into our own shadows. But as Ajahn Manisara said, her family is Thai, and she grew up in the Philippines, and she said that Christianity was in the drinking water, and so she picked up all sorts of Catholic ideas just by being there. And I think like that's a nice, like an interesting way to think about the kinds of things that we will pick up that maybe kind of lurk in our shadows and that we don't know are there, and our attitudes to what and the ways that we relate to different kinds of people, I guess, right? And who we say are the external monsters, right? Who we say so both in kind of like trans circles and also in disability circles. And this is the other thing that kind of triggered my thought process over the last few weeks, was thinking about these the current declining situation of rights for people living with disabilities. We've seen the massive cuts for the NDIS, and then all sorts of strange and wild and unfortunate things happening in the United States, both for people living with disabilities, trans people, queer people, people of colour, people who are otherwise put in situations where they have less privilege for whatever reason. These people, we're told stories about them and their worth and their value. And this has been going on for a long time, you know, and these are the kinds of things that are in our drinking water, right? For my whole life, I've been told the story that people in the Middle East are warlike creatures, right? Is that a story that, yeah, right? And I didn't even think about this until really recently, and I was like, my whole life, I'm turning 45 in a few weeks' time, my whole life this is the story I've been told about people in Iraq and Iran and Palestine and Israel and Lebanon and those places. And I mean, like, I didn't even see that bias in my mind. It was like, you know, people brush off the conflict in the Middle East like there's something wrong with the people in the Middle East. No. No, we're all humans. And it was like a shocking revelation to see that little dark corner. And so then we're told, like, you know, it's like a justification for what's going on over there right now. It's the justification for our fuel prices. Right? It's pretty intense. And there's so many different stories that kind of just sink in, and it's really sad because it becomes internalized amongst those people who are from that background, for example, right? It, whether you're, you know, a person of color, then due to colonialism, unfortunately, your value in the hierarchy of power is different. And I mean, this is basically what's happening in the Middle East. It's people conquering for the benefit of oil. So if you've grown up in that, then like we just internalize these things, whether it's through, if we've grown up with, say, disability, if we've grown up as a person of color, if we've grown up as a queer or trans person, or any of those things, even as a woman, we've been told, we've been painted a characteristic of, like, a caricature of how we should act. And it's like in the drinking water, and we're just like dancing that little dance within society. And so that's where the center of the Venn diagram kind of overlaps, right? It's that those things we take on board, just checking the sound is working. Okay, good. it's the things that we take on board that kind of skew us, and it can take like our whole lifetime to even notice that we're drinking this tap water, right? And interestingly enough, I found an example of ableism in the Sangha in the Buddha's time, which I thought was interesting, and then how the Buddha dealt with it. So that was going to be the first. Oh, come on, internet. I had all my sutras loaded up and now it's decided to reload. Good thing. I came with a tree version. Okay, great. Okay, so the first sutra I thought I'd bring up was Buddhia the Dwarf. I don't know how tall Buddhia was and whether he actually had dwarfism, but let's see. Anyway. Okay, so at Sarvati, Venerable Buddhia the Dwarf went up to see the Buddha. The Buddha saw him coming off in the distance and addressed the mendicants. Mendicants, do you see this monk coming? Ugly, unsightly, deformed, and despised by the mendicants. Yes, sir. The mendicant, that mendicant is very mighty and powerful. It's not easy to find an attainment that he has not already attained, and he has realized the supreme end of the spiritual path in this very life. He lives having achieved with his own insight the goal for which gentlemen rightly go forth from the lay life to homelessness. That is what the Buddha said. Then the Holy One, the teacher, went on to say these verses. Geese, herons and peacocks, elephants and spotted deer, though their bodies are not equal, they all fear the lion. So it is for humans. If a little person is wise, they're the truly great one, not the fool with the good body. Isn't that an interesting find in the sutta that I was like, oh, because I'd remembered there was Buddhya the dwarf, and I was like, what's Buddhya's story? I knew he was like this great monk in the time of the Buddha. So even to see that these qualities that are in here, right? They're he's described as ugly, unsightly, deformed. Ugly, unsightly, and deformed, right? And this is often how monsters are portrayed, right? If you think of these scary characters in the movies, how do you know they're scary? They've got some sort of disfigurement in them, right? Their face is deformed, or they've got like Hunchback of Notre Dame, right? Back problems, poor guy. I sympathize. All these things, right? This is how we know these are the bad guys, right? But what's this saying, right? This is totally playing on these preconceived ideas that we've kind of got running in our minds throughout society. And you know, I was reading about how different characters have been created over time. And it really is through these different things, like not just physical deformities, but like ogres. Ogres are often described as having of little intelligence, right? And so this is another way that we rank humans. And I did, I just noticed now, I ranked myself against Kai Cheng Tom. So I'm not immune from this. So it is another way that we even rank humans. And this is, you know, this is this idea even of IQ, right? People talk about having, you know, you're really good at, like you're really smart. You must have a really high IQ. What's your IQ? This was developed for eugenics. This was developed for selective breeding of the smart peoples. Don't buy into the IQ thing. And then, so everyone's like, oh, yeah, well, IQ is nothing. EQ. EQ is Buddhist eugenics, people. Don't do that either. Right? Emotional quotient. Rather than intelligence quotient, it's a trick, right? And how do we know this? What does the Buddha say about this? The Buddha talks about the three kinds of conceit. I don't have the sutta reference here, but it's in the Anguttara Sixes. Look on index.readingfaithfully.org. You'll find the sutta. It's great. But anyway, so the three kinds of conceit. So when a person comes to the Buddha's hanging out with Venerable Ananda, and this person comes to the Buddha and says, I'm not better, I'm not worse, and I'm not the same as anyone else, and walks away. And this other monk comes up to the Buddha and says, I'm not better, I'm not worse, and I'm not the same as anyone else, and walks away. And the Buddha turns to Venerable Ananda and says, These are two enlightened beings. This is how they announce their enlightenment to me. And we can, you know, from what we've already kind of looked at and discussed, we can see how, like, the better and worse might be playing out. But even this conceit that I'm the same,
when you believe that you're the same as someone else, you're shutting off the knowledge that we're just cause and effect. We're just conditions, right? And everyone's conditions are the same. You know, like I was saying back at the beginning, everyone, we've all grown up in different kinds of soil with different kinds of fertilizer, to use a metaphor, right? And so we're absolutely not the same. Even if you've grown up in the same family, you know, my siblings and I, not the same. So this is another kind of conceit, right? And I guess, I mean, it's not a lesser conceit because it shuts us off from seeing things as they are again, right? It's putting all those preconceived ideas that we have about people who were this color or this height or this age or this gender or whatever. And, you know, look, the dangerous thing right now is the people who are heavily buying into this idea of the modified human, the hierarchy of humans. We can see this with the, like, the tech bros and all this kind of new age eugenics that's happening with people like Elon Musk and all those other tech bros over in the US, right? They're heavily, you know, and the right in general, they're saying these people are less valuable, these people are more valuable. And I haven't got a source except for Bhante Sujato. I don't know what his source was, but Bhante Sujato said in a talk a couple of years ago now about Elon Musk that Elon Musk had the plan to colonize Mars only with white people because white people won't fight with each other. World War II, World War I. Okay, so crazy stuff. So you can see, like, how dangerous this idea can be, and why, and once we start, say, going and discriminating against people based on their bodies, it's a slippery slope before it comes to any of you guys, right? It might start with people with disabilities. It might start with trans people, but, like, they're already, you know, rolling back in the States. They're rolling back the option for abortion and for women to have autonomy over their bodies, right? Because they're, women are lesser beings. They're owned by men. You see this in this whole trad wife movement. It's like full on. So, again, you know, this seeing what's going on kind of underneath with all these different things that are kind of happening is pretty full on. I have so many suitors. I'm like, how am I going to get through all these? But the really scary thing is we think, okay, so we're not the monsters. They're the monsters, right? The Elon Musk, the Donald Trumps, the Netanyahu's, whoever else, right? We think that. But we're all here in samsara, and the Buddha asks in the Sanyutta Nikaya, which is more, the flow of blood from having your head chopped off while roaming around and transmigrating in samsara, or the water in all the great oceans? Right? And so the monks reply, as we understand the Buddha's teaching, the flow of blood we've shed when our heads have been chopped off while roaming and transmigrating is more than the water in the four great oceans. Good, good, mendicants. It's good that you understand my teaching like this. The flow of blood you've shed when your head was chopped off while roaming and transmigrating is indeed more than the water in the four great oceans. For a long time, you've been cows. And the flow of blood you've shed when your head was chopped off as a cow is more than the water in the four great oceans. For a long time, you've been buffalo, sheep, goats, deer, chickens, pigs, and for a long time, you've been bandits arrested for raiding villages, highway robbery, or adultery.
and the flow of blood you shed when your head was chopped off as a bandit is more than the water in the four great oceans. Why is that? Transmigrating has no known beginning. This is quite enough for you to become disillusioned, dispassionate, and freed regarding all conditions. You've also been the person who's doing the head chopping, right? If you've been a bandit, you've been a highway robber, you've been an adulterer, you've done all these things. And as long as we're in samsara, there is this possibility that we could become that next dictator, right? Because we have those dark shadows, those things in the corners. I don't get angry. I'm not judgmental. I don't have prejudice. Sure, I do. It's there, right? Unless you're enlightened, it's going to be there. So having that humility is really something, right? And suttas like this for me really kind of bring that home, is that, yeah, look, I have that nature within myself. You know, I've shed liters and liters and liters of blood, caused all this harm. It's quite the thing, right? And so, yeah. Okay, I have my favorite monster in the sutras now. Just to bring things up a bit, because, I mean, we've got kind of dark, and that was probably as dark as we're getting. We're coming up now, don't worry, guys. Suchiloma is my favorite monster in the suttas. And so Suchiloma was a yucca. Who I like to, the yuccas are like the native spirits in the Buddhist realm. And there's all sorts of other wonderful and magical and mystical beings. So Suchiloma was, at one time, the Buddha was staying in Gaia at the Cutstone Ledge, where in the haunt where Suchiloma, Spiky was his name, Spiky the native spirit. I always think of the yuccas as trolls, but native spirit will do. Now, at the time, the native spirits, Shaggy and Spiky, were passing by not far from the Buddha. So Shaggy said to Spiky, "That's not a real aesthetic. That's no aesthetic. He's a fake. I'll soon find out whether he's an aesthetic or a fake." So then Spiky went up to the Buddha and leaned up against his body, but the Buddha pulled away. Then Spiky said to the Buddha, "Are you afraid, aesthetic?" "No, venerable sir, I'm not afraid. No, respectable sir, I'm not afraid, but your touch is nasty. I will ask you a question, aesthetic, and if you don't answer me, I'll drive you insane. I'll explode your heart or grab you by the feet and throw you to the far shore of the Ganges." Bhante-Sajjata has a note here. The Ganges was 200 kilometers away. Big throw. Because they're in Gaia. Okay, so I don't see anyone in the world with its gods, Maras, and divinity, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its gods and humans, who could do that to me. But anyway, ask me what you wish. Where do greed and hate come from? From where springs discontent, desire, and terror? Where do the mind's thoughts originate? Like a crow let loose by boys. And so the Buddha answers, greed and hate come from here. From here springs discontent, desire, and terror. Here's where the mind's thoughts originate. Like a crow let loose by boys. Born of affection originating in oneself. Like prop roots sprouting from a banyan. The many kinds of attachments to sensual pleasures are like the camel's foot creeper creeping through the woods. Those who understand where they come from get rid of them. Listen up, spirit. Cool, right? I mean, I like Spiky. He's easy to remember. His whole, like, sidling up to the Buddha is, like, a really nice example of how there's this idea in
what my friend Bhante Jayasara calls Reddit Buddhism. it's broader than Reddit, but it's this like no judging, man. Right? Like Buddhists, they just have to be cool with everything. Like the Buddha, there was an unpleasant feeling and he had a choice and he could step away. So this is in Buddhist drinking water that we have to just endure. Enduring is one of the things the Buddha said we could do, but we also have the option for discernment, right? So, and I think that's like really worth reflecting on, because we're thinking, going back to being a good Buddhist, to be a good Buddhist, we think that we have to just accept everything, right? No matter what it is. But like Buddha did not cuddle up with Spikey. So next time you're like, oh, I'm a bad person for like stepping away from that difficult thing, remember Spikey the Yucca. Yeah. So there's another one of my, I'm just kind of doing best of the monsters now, like just to bring things up a bit, because there's another story, and you'll probably have heard this one if you've listened to Ajahn Brahm's talks, and it's called Ugly. It's in the Samyutta Nikaya, Samyutta 11.22 for Michael for when he's doing the show notes. So Nirsavati in Jeta's Grove, once upon a time, mendicants, there was a native spirit who was ugly and deformed. Ah, poor native spirits. He sat on the throne of Sukha, Lord of the Gods. But the God of the 33 complained, grumbled, and objected. O Lord, how incredible, how amazing. This ugly and deformed spirit is sitting on the throne of Sukha, the Lord of the Gods. But the more the gods complained, the more attractive, good-looking, and lovely that spirit became. So this is where it deviates from the Ajahn Brahm story, because Ajahn Brahm has the monster becoming more and more disgusting, more and more dripping with ooze, more and more fierce. Okay, so this is like how, but this is where the Ajahn Brahm story comes from. So the gods went up to Sukha and told him what was happening. Indra, who is another, is Sukha, replied, surely, good fellow, that must be the anger-eating spirit. Then Sukha went up to that spirit, arranged his robe over one shoulder, knelt down with his right knee on the ground, raised his cupped palms towards the anger-eating spirit, and pronounced his name three times, good fellow, I am Sukha, Lord of the Gods. Good fellow, I am Sukha, Lord of the Gods. Good fellow, I am Sukha, Lord of the Gods. But the more Sukha pronounced his name, the uglier and more deformed the spirit became, until eventually it vanished right there. Then Sukha, Lord of the Gods, guiding the gods of the 33, spoke this verse. My mind isn't easily upset. I'm not easily drawn into a maelstrom. I don't get angry for long. Anger doesn't last in me. But when I get angry, I don't speak harshly, nor do I advertise my own virtues. I carefully restrain myself out of regard for my own welfare. Interesting, right? So we probably have anger-eating demons in our own lives that feed on anger and even want us to be angry, right? I mean, this is what this monster was kind of going for. So again, in both these cases, Sukha and the Buddha addressed the monster with respect, right? Honorable sir, good friend, good sir. But didn't tolerate any hoo-ha, any trouble. So, you know, we can see this, and maybe, you know, we can practice this. In our meditation, sometimes we're like, oh, this is unpleasant. We have these unpleasant things. And I don't know what your experience was, say, in the meditation that we had earlier, but the attitude that we bring to things is kind of what gets mirrored back to us as well. So, and having that sense of curiosity, right,
to look into those spaces, to look into that darkness in a different way, right? To look into that darkness with respect, because like in that quote at the beginning from Kai Cheng Tom, then it's like these monsters, they're so powerful, these monsters inside of us, but if we push them away, they are just going to get more smelly, more nasty, or they're just going to hang out in those dark corners and jump out when we're least expecting them. They're very powerful forces if we don't know them. But if we greet them with respect, like the way that Sucker, then they'll diminish and shrink down, right? They'll be manageable. They'll be within our realm, right, within our ability to recognize. So that's my second and third favorite monster. I'm not going to get stuck into my number one monster because it just doesn't fit in with the theme of the talk tonight. But I do recommend you look up the first ever internet troll before the internet ever happened, Alavika was a lightning bhikkhuni. Alavika was a monster who trolled the Buddha big time. It's a very funny sutta in the Sanyutta Nikaya, no, in the Sutta Nipata. So I recommend you check him out because, cool monster. But coming back to this idea of discernment, right, and this idea of knowing when to step away from things, when someone is, well, I'll let the sutta speak, right? So when a foolish, incompetent, untrue person has four qualities, they keep themselves broken and damaged. And this is an internal quality, right? They deserve to be blamed and criticized by sensible people, and they brim with much wickedness. What for? Without examining or scrutinizing, they praise those deserving of criticism, and they criticize those deserving of praise. They arouse faith in things that are dubious, and they don't arouse faith in things that are inspiring. When a foolish, incompetent, untrue person possesses these four qualities, they keep themselves broken and damaged. They deserve to be blamed and criticized by sensible people, and they brim with much wickedness. However, when an astute, competent, true person has four qualities, they keep themselves intact and unscathed. They don't deserve to be blamed and criticized by sensible people, and they brim with much merit. What for? After examining and scrutinizing, they criticize those deserving of criticism, and they praise those deserving of praise. They don't arouse faith in things that are dubious, and they do arouse faith in things that are inspiring. When an astute, competent, true person possesses these four qualities, they keep themselves intact and unscathed. They don't deserve to be blamed and criticized by sensible people, and they brim with much merit. When you praise someone worthy of criticism or criticize someone worthy of praise, you choose a losing hand with your own mouth. You'll never find happiness that way. A losing hand at dice is a trivial thing. If all you lose is your money and all your own, even yourself, what's a really terrible hand is to hate the holy ones for 100,000 times, for 100,000 times, 100 million times, 536 times, 1,000 times, 10 million years, a slanderer noble one goes to hell, having aimed bad words and thoughts at them. I mean, that's like some pretty hardcore criticism, but it's, you know, like that's a big number, whatever that was, 100,036 or whatever it was. that's a long time in hell. But we can see that having that wisdom and having that discernment, right, is an important quality. Obviously, the Buddha is bringing this up. And to use these terms for people who do not have this discernment, to call them broken and damaged, right? This is this is where we should be looking when we're criticizing people, right? These are the qualities that we should actually be judging people on, right? Not these external appearances, even their like emotional intelligence, how nice they can be to me, right? I mean, that's really what that's really what we're thinking when we're talking about emotional intelligence. We're like, oh, how did they make me feel? I'm so important. So these are the values, right? And so what we have, what we can look at is what do we value, right? And so out in the world, we are conditioned, right? The drinking water of our lives is to go to school so we can go to university, so we can get the job, so we can get the money, so we can get the car, so we can get the house, so we can get the partner, so we can do the things, so that we can beat everyone else and move up the ladder. And while we're doing it, we have to come top of the class. And doesn't matter. Like, we are taught to compete. We are taught to acquire. We are taught to trample everything down to get to our goal, right? And I know this because I worked in advertising and marketing. Wrong livelihood, people. Well, depends what you're doing. I mean, if you're trying to get people to do like health habits, or I did also work for the education department doing design, so I was like doing good things there. But there was a time I remember being very distinctly being on a call with a client who was also a friend, and they run a fitness business. And I was like, if you say this person will feel dissatisfied and they'll come to you to solve their problem. And I went, oh my gosh, I'm a bad person. But this is how advertising works, right? I ordained not long after that, don't worry, people. But this is how advertising works. This is what society tells us, right? We go out in the world, we doom scroll. What are we doing? We're comparing our lives to what we see in those little 15-second, 10-second, 5-second clips, right? This is what Facebook is. It's like the internal ranking system in our minds of all our peoples. Like this again, this is the drinking water that we swim in if we are not aware of it, right? And maybe, you know, thinking about this, it can then help us direct where we do, like, spend our time with our mind, right? It's the foundation for what do we actually think is important? What are we giving attention to, right? And so, you know, coming back to this sutta where the Buddha praises the wise, and, you know, what kinds of things do the wise value, right? So this is wrong view versus right view. Wrong view is just to get ahead and win, and doesn't matter about respecting your parents, doesn't matter about respecting people who have spiritual development, does not matter about generosity because you want to hoard all your stuffs. Right, you want to protect all the things, and it's all about the individual, right, in this culture, and even more so since we've got on the internet, even more so since we all kind of got, you know, isolated by COVID, and then like that really had a huge effect on building up, like, even before I ordained, the cult of the personality that everyone was like producing their own personal brand to put out on social media and curating their identity, that was just starting. But it has been refined to a T now, right? What we put out, what we protect, right? What we protect now, right? We're so worried about people, the wrong people having our phone numbers, the wrong people having our addresses. Does anyone remember a thing called the white pages? Okay. Like, okay, you can just look someone up. We're so scared of the rest of the world now. We're so, like, protective of our identity. People getting to know us, people, like,
it's incredible. And that's like, I mean, the white pages were around 25 years ago. Like, we were looking people up and calling them and dropping in on their houses and stuff like this, right? It's like, oh, I met this person. I'd like to drop around and say hi. I'll just look them up on the white page. Now, oh, my gosh, if someone calls you rather than sending you a message, what are they doing? They're interrupting me. Side rant. Anyway. We are so protective of me and mine in so many different ways. And this, like, we've curated this very precious kind of, all our stuff has to be like looked after and held, right? If we're, and like, this is based back on this ranking of the individual, right? Like, people don't have individual value in a society that has different values, right? Like, even looking back in that time, the individual has become stronger. And this way that we rank people in like, this person, you know, in the beauty contest of Facebook, in the intelligence contest of Blue Sky, whatever it is, all these things, right? Like, they're things that we value and protect and rank each other against. Right view is that people who have cared for us and raised us have value. People who have wisdom, spiritual understanding have value. That there are consequences for our actions, for ourselves and for others in this life and in future lives. And that what we do plays out in a multitude of ways through conditionality, right? And so when we understand this, we make different choices, right? So based on right view, our intention is different. Based on the view of the person who dies with the most toys wins, then we foster greed, hatred, and delusion. Based on the view that the caring for people matters, that our actions have consequences, that developing skillful states of mind, skillful action, skillful speech have real, tangible benefits for ourselves and for the people around us, that the deer and the spotted deer and the antelope and the peacock all fear the lion, right? And so do we. We don't want to be killed. We don't want people to lie to us. We don't want people to steal from us. And so, remembering this, we have a different set of values which set about a different kind of intention, sama sankapa, right? And so through bringing up this intention, we make choices of generosity and renunciation. We make choices of kindness and gentleness in how we move through the world, right? Based on our values, based on what's important to us. And this is what right view is, understanding this cause and effect, that our actions do have consequences. Because if we're scared of all the monsters we're going to be protecting and acquiring and hoarding, right? But if we want to grow in wisdom, if we want to expand the light, then we have to open up, right? And so this is the third factor of then to be able to do this, right? We have the third factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is right action, right? So this is basically our five precepts, the recognition that not just humans but all lives have value, not because
we're ranking them, and like animals are down here and humans are up here and white rich men are up here, whatever it is, right? Like all beings, the Buddha said, sabbe satta bhavantu sukhitata, may all beings be happy, right? All beings fear pain. All beings tremble at the knife. And so with this knowledge, this is a great motivation for us to keep the five precepts, right? Because these precepts are safeguards for ourselves. They're safeguards for our loved ones and the people who are close to us. And it's, you know, for the whole world, right? Without this respect and self-respect and respect for others, Hiri and Otapa, there's nothing that we wouldn't do, right? One who would tell a lie, there's nothing that they would not do to cover up that lie. That's what the Buddha said. So that brings us on to why we have right speech even as another factor in the Eightfold Path. So lying, divisive speech, right? Because that's another way that we gain advantage and power and status and rank. Speech that is harsh and causes harm through our words. And sampalapa. We've only got Pei who knows what sampa is. Sampa is rubbish in Malay and Indonesian, right? Right? So sampalapa is rubbish speech, but we see so much of this now coming out. Misinformation and the caricatures of people, right? I was looking at an article from a while ago about AI and how AI represented Australians. Yeah, right? Everyone cringed. And the horrible caricatures, especially of Indigenous Australians, right? And it was quite a shocking thing to see, because this is what AI does. It takes all the stuffs and averages it out. It averages out all our prejudices, all our delusions, all the stuffs that's in the drinking water. And that's what it shows you, right? It's an algorithm. It's not intelligent. It's like a word salad with probability, or picture salad with probability. So this is why we need to be so very careful with misinformation, with checking our sources, with looking at what we share, especially in this age, because it could be something that's just in our drinking water, right? It's something that we haven't actually questioned whether this is true or not, whether this is valuable or not, whether this is beneficial or not. So I think, like, now more than ever, we are so lucky to have the Noble Eightfold Path, right? To have this thing that we can bring up within our day. And this is why I almost always wind up finishing up with the Eightfold Path, is because it is that gift to remind us of our values and our intention. And in this world right now, with all the difficulties and trouble and greed and hatred and delusion that are going on, we have the Buddha's teachings, we have the Noble Eightfold Path. But we have to remember this is important to us, because the drinking water is pretty powerful. Stuff that's coming through right now is very strong, right? It's easy to believe some of these things, to get caught up in, oh, well, we can't afford to care for people. We don't have time to care for people. We don't have time to investigate a little bit more, to look, to bring up that curiosity, to shine the light of kindness and wisdom on things. And so I really encourage you every day to actively set that intention for yourselves, to enter the world with a heart of generosity, with a heart of kindness, and with a heart of gentleness, right? And the last and one of the most famous bad guys in the suttas is a reformed bad guy. Where is he? Venerable Angulimala, who probably you all know, was a serial killer who went round and collected fingers on his as a necklace. That's what Angulimala means. Anguli is finger, mala is necklace or bracelet, right? And so it seemed to be some sort of ritualistic thing, and his last target, he was heading towards the Buddha. So you can read about this in Majjhima Nikaya 83. But the Buddha was able to have him stop. He became enlightened. And though he lived with the karma of his past, his rebirth was ended, right? And so the enlightenment, the poem at the end is quite a nice one. And it gives hope for even any of us and our monsters that are lurking inside of us in the corners, in the shadows, right? He who once was heedless but turned to heedfulness lights up the world like the moon freed from the clouds. Someone whose bad deeds is supplanted by the good lights up the world like the moon freed from the clouds. A young mendicant devoted to the Buddha's teachings lights up the world like the moon freed from the clouds. May even my enemies hear a Dharma talk. May even my enemies devote themselves to the Buddha's teachings. May even my enemies associate with those good men who establish others in the Dhamma. May even my enemies hear Dharma at the right time from those who teach acceptance, praising acquiescence, and may they follow the path, for then they'd never wish harm upon myself or others. Having arrived at ultimate peace, they'd look after creatures firm and frail. So I'm going to end the Dharma talk on that note and offer this for your reflection. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And, yeah, if anyone has any comments or questions, then now's the time. We have a few more minutes before we have to get out of here. Oh, my battery is running low. Okay, cool. We only have a few more minutes. That's okay. Low battery means like 10, 20 minutes. Doesn't mean 2 minutes, which is fine. Yeah, don't worry about it. Okay. So, oh, good. Oh, look, Michael's even keeping up with suttas in the chat. Thank you, Michael. Sorry, I had a question. Oh, yes. Hi.
I like at the beginning when they were describing the monster
characteristics. Yes.
And one of them was protector.
Right.
And it made me think that we do have protector monsters inside of us.
Yeah.
And this protector monster, I think, because we were hurt at one time, then
right,
this monster would protect us.
Yes.
Otherwise, if we are healed and there's no hurt inside us, then there's no need for a monster.
Right.
But then the question is, from a Buddhist philosophy, do we believe that all monsters weren't monsters before?
Well, this is
because of cause and effect. If we cancel them and we go back.
I think like our monsters and the monsters that we heard about in these stories, like the ones who were maybe, you know, even physically deformed or something like that, they became monsters through their actions, right? Like one of the when we give the blessing, we wish people long life, beauty, happiness, and strength, and this is through their good deeds. And so through the conditioning that we had, we developed this monster. And like normally these monsters come from like when we were kids and we needed a monster to protect us, right? But if we have that, like we're adults now and we have all sorts of extra like resources and things, hopefully. And so we
that monster is stuck in the dark corner of the past. And so by shining the light and recognizing these monsters who are our protectors, then we can not be so afraid of them as well, right? It's like we can have a respectful curiosity towards their role in our lives and how we relate to them, right? So so it can change our relationship with them, and then they don't, they will slowly, like in the story with Sucker, they'll shrink down, right? They'll become very small. They might even take on a different role in our lives. They might not be monsters anymore, right? We can thank the monsters for their job as protectors, but also, you know, help them to have a different rebirth inside of ourselves, right? Like all of us, like Angulimala, like our monsters can transform. They can take on different jobs. They can become enlightened. They can become free. Yeah. Question? No, just a sadhu. Hey. Oh, sorry. Did you have?
No. Mine is sort of a question and also a comment.
Yeah.
So you brought up very interesting things about like people being the rat race, you know, wanting cars, status, titles, and you know, dog eat dog, cut people down to get to achieve those goals. So well, what I'm trying to go with this is looking at the concept of demons.
Yeah.
Which you know, there's a term for it in Buddhism.
Peta or something like that. Peta? Is that what you mean by demons? Or so, anyway, never mind.
There's a term for it. Yeah. Rakshas?
Yep.
Rakshas.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
So I mean you have monsters on one hand and you have another type. I know another
Well, they're a different kind of monster, right?
So do you feel that, you know, if people are focusing on more like material aspects, they're more likely to attract those ruptures and therefore those ruptures influence. So would be fair to say that you still have control of your choices, but you could be influenced by external ruptures or monsters, and then they may encourage you to put an action, but you can still say no to going up that action.
Okay. So this was something that Bhante Nyanaloka spoke about when I first met him like 10 years ago. He was saying that demons enter you while you're on social media. And I was like, what? I was like, this is wild. But what are you doing when you're on social media, right? You're an open vessel. Your mind is like this open soup for things to come in, right? And the things that you're inviting in are the demons, right? They're like it's the comparing, it's the greed, it's the hatred, it's all those things that are the akusala, the unwholesome characters that you're just letting in. I was like, oh yeah, Bhante's right. That was just really shocking. Right? The demon, you're creating that. And like social media is like the Aluva creeper. It like has kittens and puppies on the surface. And an hour later, you're like, who knows where? And the algorithm has clocked your defilements. Right? It's like, I'm just going to show you a little bit of lust. I'm just going to show you a little bit of violence. And the demons, they